Judges aren't lying.
Good morning. I'm opening today's House Revenue Committee meeting, and we're going to start out with a public hearing because we don't have a quorum for moving anything yet, but we will later. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2519. Members of the committee, the bill as written is not exactly what we're going for here. We have amendments. So, Bazin, you want to go over them with us?
Yes, Chair Berger and members of the committee. I don't know if this is a momentous occasion or first got on stuff of the session. That's the original bill being gutted and the dash one amendment replace the bill entirely, and it's has to deal with the cleanup or process requested by the state treasurer's office. And this is a continuation of the issue about the credit unions and their ability to hold public deposits and the uninsured public deposit, and adding a process in a sense of how notification to officials and public bodies occur and how this thing going. This is a request by the state treasurer, and the state treasurer staff is also here today. They sent you a letter, but also they're here to explain why this bill is needed to complete the 2010 proposed law that was in House Bill 3700 of the 2010 session.
Questions of Mazin? Again, we are only dealing with the dash ones on this bill. Would Mike Salvaggio and Darren Bond like to come up and tell us what you're trying to do here?
Chair Berger, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer. I'll be very brief and talk about the legislative history a little bit to explain why this gut and stuff is happening, and then turn it over to our Deputy Treasurer, Darren Bond, to explain the mechanics of the bill. We had Senate Bill 12 drafted, which dealt with the first issue in these amendments, the timing of the credit union depository program. When House Bill 3700 was passed in the 2010 session, there were some deadline changes at the last minute. We ran into a situation in which the credit unions as an industry would meet some triggers requiring the state treasurer's office to establish a depository program for credit unions. And the program would have to be up and running at a particular date, regardless of when those triggers were made. And there was the possibility of the program having to be up and running in a very short amount of time, and one could see that it was possible the program would have to be up and running overnight after those triggers were met. Senate Bill 12 affected that so that we would have a 180-day lead to get this program up and running after the triggers were met, no matter what. What happened, though, was we got a relating clause that was too broad. The relating clause related to the effective date of the legislation, and then we were told by legislative counsel that we weren't actually dealing with an effective date. We were dealing with an implementation date, and so we had to find another bill to put this into. As luck would have it, we had another depository fix in the hopper that was aiming for a different bill, but since these are both depository issues, we decided that it would be most efficient just to find a vehicle that we could put all of our depository fixes into. And then I will let Deputy Bond explain the mechanics.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Darren Bond, Deputy State Treasurer. I think Mike covered the credit union issue pretty well. It's just a matter of we have to have enough time to put the the system up in place to be able to manage the credit unions. Otherwise, we'd be out of compliance with the law. The other issue relates to the current drafting of ORS 295, where there's some requirements put on the treasurer to monitor and mitigate risk for the deposit of public funds. One of the issues is for certain areas of noncompliance with the on the part of the banks, there's no enforcement mechanism in the statute. There's no way for us to do anything. And this change allows us to notify public funds depositories of the banks that are out of compliance in these certain instances, just like in the other instances. These were just oversights in the original drafting of the statute. And it's important for us to be able to mitigate risk to the system. And that would mean mitigating risk to the other banks that are in the shared liability pool under ORS 295. And the various changes just affect that. And that's it. It's pretty simple, pretty much a housekeeping bill, fixing oversights in the statutes on one hand and in the drafting of the bill on the other.
Questions? Representative Warren.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. We just received this, so please pardon me if my questions seem a little foolish, but isn't the enforcement mechanism the public body withdrawing their funds from the depository?
Madam Chair, Representative Wong, that's exactly right, but the public entity needs to be aware of the issues, and the treasurer is the management arm of the government relative to ORS 295 and the security of public funds. So we would have the information that the bank was out of compliance. The public entity wouldn't unless we were able to notify them, and as the current statute's drafted, we're not. So that's what this allows, is notification to the public entity so that they can make the decision to remove their funds.
Follow-up. Yes. Thank you. So this allows you to notify the public bodies after a grace period. Current law doesn't allow that. Does this amendment give you any other types of powers relative to the situation?
Madam Chair, Representative Wong, no.
Thank you.
Further questions? Yes, Representative Pence.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I was just curious on the first page, Section 13, Line 9, it said, for the purpose of paying initial or continuing expenses, and I was just wondering why the bill, when originally crafted, only called out the initial expenses.
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, that's a ledge council question. Honestly, I don't know. I mean, we do need to be able to pay for getting the system up and running and then for it to be on an ongoing basis. And the idea is that they have to be able to pay for us to implement the system, and then they also have to be able to pay for us to manage the system for a period of time until the revenues generated from the program can do it. So that was the agreement with the credit unions when it was drafted, that they would provide the funding up front to allow the treasurer to manage it so it didn't have to be subsidized from any other programs.
Yes, Representative Benz.
Thank you. That must have been what they were thinking, that the word initial would cover that initial cost, and then the program itself would pay the rest. And this is merely expanding upon that thought.
Right. I think this just – I don't believe this is any change at all relative to the agreement that the treasurer and the credit unions had and how this would be financed. This is just LC's attempt to better clarify the language since it was in front of them again for some revisions.
Further questions? For the sake of the memories, the committee I was on, the committee last session that heard this, and it was somewhat hurried, which is my memory, in terms of its okay. Any other questions? Anyone else like to weigh in on this bill? Anyone in purple out there like to weigh in on this bill? No. Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on this, and it will be continued. Okay. Thank you, and I'm going to open a public hearing while we're in public hearing on House Bill 2820. The last one on your agenda. Again, for members of the committee, we are not talking about the original bill here. In case you're in panic, we are talking about proposed amendments. So, Dave, do you want to talk about the proposed amendments to 2820?
Chair Berding, members of the committee. Excuse me, Chair Berger.
Close enough. Dave, don't worry about it.
This bill increases annual license fees for the operation of career schools, and it allows the State Board of Education to adopt by rule annual license fees for career schools and fees for certain activities related to career schools. Makes such change operative starting from July 1, 2013, declares an emergency, and takes effect on July 1, 2011.
Thank you. Questions of Day? We got the Department of Education, whose bill this is, to come and explain it to us. So if Cindy and Teresa want to come up. Again, we are not talking about, for the public out there, the original bill. We are talking about proposed amendments only.
Co-chairs Berger and Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Hunt, and I'm the Government and Legal Affairs Manager for the Oregon Department of Education. The amendments you have today in front of you would gut and stuff the original bill. They're originally contained in another bill that went through the Higher Education Subcommittee in the House this session and received a unanimous vote out of that committee. What the amendments do is affect private career schools right now in Oregon. What a private career school is these are the schools that produce students in cosmetology, truck driving, pet grooming, welding, tattooing, that kind of thing. There's approximately 257 of these schools currently licensed in Oregon, and each year they have nearly 18,000 students who graduate from these schools and go into our workforce. The fees that are the subject of the amendments are currently in statute and have not been increased for more than 10 years. What we are doing today is asking for an increase in the fees and then placing the ability to increase the fees into rules so that we can increase them based on the consumer price index and that kind of thing. When we were formulating this proposal, we spoke to the industry on this proposal. We also have a private career school advisory committee, and both the industry and the committee are in support of this proposal. What we would be doing with the revenue that is generated from the fee increase is offering more technical assistance to the industry, more regulation. We also believe the incidences of student complaints and school complaints should go down with this as well. And with that, we're asking that you adopt the amendments and send the bill to Ways and Means. With me today is also Teresa Green, and she is the director at our agency that oversees this area if you have additional questions.
Questions for the committee, from the committee.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just so I understand, because I'm seeing in the proposed amendments, Section 1, you're pulling out the in-state and out-of-state schools' tuition range fees, then you're putting it back in on page 2 on line 14, and then you're asking to adopt by rule the fee structure.
Right. Co-Chair Berger, Representative Iyer Brewer, what we're doing is, you're correct, on page 1, the existing fees come out. So, for example, for a school that has a tuition income range of $0 to $15,000, the existing fee is $450. And then on page 2 shows the new fees, And so for that same income range, for example, the fee would be $600. That's what would be in effect for this coming biennium, and also would be subject to other funds limitations and that kind of thing from Ways and Means. Then after this coming biennium, starting on July 1st, 2013, the fee ability to increase the fees would be placed in rule. And where that's at in the amendments is on page 3, section 2, on lines 26 and 27.
Yes.
Just one follow-up question. Thank you, Madam Chair. So these commercial schools have in-state, or wait, it's in-state schools and out-of-state schools. Can you explain the difference between them?
Co-Chair Berger, Representative Iyer Brewer. For the record, I'm Teresa Green from the Department of Education. I'm the director who oversees this program. We have some schools that have their headquarters are in another state, but they want to offer an education program in the state of Oregon, and so they establish what we call a presence, a physical presence in the state, either by having an actual school here, or they'll have maybe some just instructors who are employed by them who reside here and offer the instruction here in the state. And we consider those to be out-of-state schools. Most of our schools are in-state. We only have, I think, maybe 20 schools that are actually out-of-state.
Representative Warren, you had a question?
Representative Arbrewer already covered it.
Covered your question.
Good job.
Yes, thank Representative Vance.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Could you explain the expansion, if there is one, of the opportunity to for the board to establish the fees? So it looks as though you had some fee authority under the existing statute, and it looks like it's now been expanded. Am I correct?
Co-Chair Berger, Representative Vance, are you referring to the fee increase for the tuition income range, or are you referring to the other kind of miscellaneous fees?
Follow up.
Yes.
I'm asking, just express, if you can, the expansion of authority for the board to establish fees, and then tell me where, if there is such an expansion. I can find it in this amendment.
Co-Chair Berger, Representative Vance, the tuition income range fees are set in statute. So, for example, the one I referred to earlier, the $450, the state board could not increase or decrease that fee under current statutory authority. And so, and then for the coming biennium, that fee, for example, is set at the $600. So the state board also could not increase or decrease that fee for the coming biennium because it's established in statute. But starting on July 1st, 2013, the state board could then, by rule, adjust those particular fees upwards or downwards and go through the rulemaking process with that. The other area where the state board's authority has been altered in this bill, I would draw your attention to page 3 of the amendments, is that currently it talks about the board adopting rules and collecting fees and so forth, but on page 3, some of the very specific fees are laid out that the state board could charge for, and those would include for teacher registrations, copies of student transcripts, submissions of applications to renew a license, submissions of payments to the tuition protection. But we have this existing under a broader kind of language in the existing statute, but this lays it out more clearly.
Follow up.
Yes.
Thank you. Well, that is my question. It looked to me as though you have some of this authority, and this is either clarifying it or expanding it. So that's why I'm having trouble figuring out.
Yeah. Co-Chair Berger, Representative Benz. We already have in the statute certain fees, like the teacher registration fees, the transcript fees. Those are already there. They are already in operation. What we have done is we've added. We currently collect late fees if they turn their renewal application in late. We collect a late fee, but when it was put into statute, it was characterized as a civil penalty, which was not the intention. It was supposed to be put in as an administrative fee so that it would come into our operating budget to help compensate for the fact that they're late, and that causes some problems. But that's not the way it got done. So we're trying to fix that, and so that became one of the fees that was added there. Then we also wanted to add an investigative fee, because we've had some schools that we've had to spend hundreds and hundreds of hours doing an in-depth investigation with, and find that they are out of compliance in a variety of ways. And rather than penalizing the other schools that are doing the job that they're supposed to do by using the fees that they pay to pay for that investigation, we wanted a way to make that school bear the burden of its own mistake by having an investigative fee. So that is the expansion of the fees that is in this bill.
Follow up?
Yes.
I'm not on Ways and Means, so I really don't know where boards enjoy authority to establish fees. And one of the things I'll be interested in, Madam Co-Chair, is understanding whether this authority is anything new, and I'm sure we'll have an opportunity to figure that out. Whether it's something that all boards enjoy, that's what's of greatest interest to me.
Yes, thank you. Yes, Representative Warren.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So on the out-of-state tuition, does that include online learning?
Co-Chair Berger, Representative Wand, yes, it does. And it's one of those areas that we need to do some more work on.
Yes, thank you.
Anything else?
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you. Following up on Representative Bent's line of questioning, some boards and commissions have the authority to raise fees, which then have to be confirmed at the next session of the legislature. Does this fall into that category, or would it simply be adopted by normal rule without any required follow-up by the legislature? If you were to change the fees pursuant to this second section.
In my conversations with Becky, I think that we do have to get confirmation.
Yeah. Co-Chair Barnhart, we believe that we would have to get confirmation by the legislature on any fee increase. Up until this point, because our fees were in statute, we didn't fall under that because essentially the legislature had already given us approval. The other piece, if this helps also, is that these fees are considered to be other funds. And so the legislature gives us an other funds expenditure limitation in this area. And so even if we were to raise our fees, we could only expend up to the amount of the limitation that the legislature gives us.
Could I follow up?
Please.
So in effect, you could raise the fees once, but you end up having to get approval from the Ways and Means process for spending the money and for keeping the increase, and for keeping the new fee schedule.
Right. Chair Barnhart, that's correct. Exactly.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further questions? I had one just about this program. You said there are 257 schools, 18,000 students. How much oversight do you have on things, or record keeping do you have on, like, graduation rates or any? Do you keep statistics on sort of the efficacy of this program?
Co-Chair Berger, if you do,
how do you fund it?
Co-Chair Berger, thank you for that question. We do require that the schools report certain statistics about their students. We require that they report their graduation rates and their placement rates. And I personally think the rates are a bit low, and it's one of the things that we want to look at in the future. Our program is not funded with any general fund at all, so these fees are the only way that we fund everything that we do with the schools. And so all the technical assistance that we give them, if we see that they're kind of going down the tubes there, it all comes out of these fees.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you very much, ladies. again, I'm going to we're not going to move this. Time for further questions, any other information. But I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2820. Now we're going to go to the top of our agenda, since we have a full and open a work session on House Bill 2328A. Members of the committee, when last seen, we were about to move this bill when it was noted that by our rules it had to go to Ways and Means. It is your co-chair's sense that this is a policy choice that needs to go to the floor. So what we have done is our staff has been busy at work dividing the policy from the part that has significant that has significant fiscal, that it is our intention that that would follow in another bill, but would not be implemented unless the policy piece completes its cycle through this building. And I present that to you as sort of the thinking of the chairs for you to dwell on while Mazin goes through the two amendments that are before us.
Members of the committee, you have, as the chair indicated, we tried to separate the policy of establishing the vehicle charge, per mile vehicle charge, from the building, the system, and the collection process, and all the other processes around this issue with ODOT. So you have in front of you two amendments, the Dash 14 or A14 and the A15. The A14 and the A15 are, for the most part, very similar, with the exception that the Dash 14 does give the Department of Transportation the ability in Section 6 to have rules and work the rules of the collection process. That was thought to be part of the rulemaking process that might facilitate the policy, but not necessarily stand in the way of that split from the budgetary process. The A15 does not have that, does not have the rulemaking process, just in case if that piece gets into the issue with the budget expenditures and so on. Now, just one more thing to have your attention to: in both the A14 and the 15, we have amended the whereas statements to include the issue about the reliance on foreign oil, and that you would find it on line 17 and 18 of the second page of both. But unfortunately, Madam Chair, we don't have fiscal.
We're working those people very hard.
Yes.
We hope they're not watching TV. We hope they're hurrying these documents to us. Representative Bailey, you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just so I make sure I understand the distinction here, the A14s, in my mind at least, seem to be preferable. The issue is whether or not that particular provision triggers the fiscal impact, which we are trying to avoid through this separation. Is that correct?
As usual, Mr. Bailey, Representative Bailey, you've gotten to the heart of the matter.
Madam Co-Chair, may I follow up with
the comment? Yes, please.
Madam Co-Chair, I really appreciate the work that you and the others have done on getting this ready to go directly to the floor for the policy provisions. I completely agree that this is a policy choice that the body needs to make, and that the fiscal provisions of the bill are necessary in carrying out the policy should we choose to move forward with the policy, but that we need to untangle those issues and present a clear choice in front of the body, and I appreciate you taking this path.
Thank you. Thank you. Further comments? Is there good understanding of the amendments before us? We've worked this thing forever. I don't want to belabor it further, but I think what I'm going to do is we have another bill to hear, so I'm going to close this temporarily. Hopefully we'll get back to it today, and I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2328A-whatever, and open a work session on House Bill 2572. As you recall, it's been a while on this one, so let's go over it. We might even have the counties come over and talk about it since it's their bill. Christine.
Chair Berger, members of the committee, House Bill 2572 would allow any of the other parties involved in a property tax appeal to seek a determination from the body or tribunal or court of the real market value of the property tax account, either in whole or in part or both. The fiscal impact of this is that there is no expenditure impact, and the revenue impact is indeterminate depending on the circumstances around these cases and how many of these determinations are sought and what the outcomes are. And this can happen. There could be cases in which parties might only appeal one part of an account and get the value lowered. However, the account as a whole would be lowered by that same amount, but might be worth more, and commonly accepted to be worth more than it would be if it were just reduced by that one component. So this would allow them to seek a determination of the value as a whole of the account.
Questions for the committee, for the no questions? You ready to move it?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2572 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barnhart moves House Bill 2572 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any comments? Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will not be in support of this bill.
Thank you. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm also not going to be supporting this bill. I'm concerned about the way that it alters the calculation and the strategy for both sides in these types of cases. And I'm not entirely comfortable with it, so I'm going to be a no on this here in committee. And, you know, if my concerns are resolved later, I may change on the floor, but right now I'm a no. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Wand expressed the reservations he just expressed again at the time we had our hearing on the bill, and I thought about it pretty carefully because, generally speaking, the objection he raised is very well taken. The reason I thought we ought to move this bill is that the way our very unfortunate constitutional provisions work now, it is that once a property tax gets ratcheted down through a mechanism in which only a part of the actual property is being considered, you can't go back. You can't look at it again and bring it up the next year because you have Measure 50 considerations to deal with when the market value and the assessed value are the same, and that is often the case in dealing with industrial and business kinds of property. And what that means is that if an assessor were to over-assess one component of a property and under-assess a different component of a property, the taxpayer could get the value of the entire property ratcheted down below its real market value altogether by appealing only the component that had been overvalued. In most situations, in other kinds of legal proceedings, it would mean that there would be an underassessment for a year, and then the assessor would catch up. He would reassess the other piece, and it would go back up to the actual real market value. With Measure 50, that can't happen because of the limitation on Measure 50. And the result is that through mechanisms like this, slowly but surely properties can be ratcheted down, and and never come back up. And I think that's one of the mechanisms by which, not the only, but one of the mechanisms by which a commercial business, commercial industrial properties are paying a lower share of the real property taxes than used to be the case before Measure 50. Now, there are other reasons, but this is one of them. That being the case, it seemed to me, and it still seems to me, that the normal rule having to do with sort of the tactics and strategies between parties in an appeal situation really can't be allowed to apply here, because it means that we end up with an unfair property assessment, which affects all other taxpayers and everybody who depends upon the services provided by the property tax. And that in this instance, at least, the normal rule that you can't sort of open up the whole world is less important than the rule that property should be assessed fairly. So that's the reason why I urge that the bill come forward and why I made the motion and why I intend to support it.
I might make a follow-up. The part, a comment, thank you, Madam Chair, is that it's the componentization. If perhaps we aren't interested, I don't understand why we have component valuation if we are going to disregard the components. And perhaps the real fix should be to do away with allocation of value to components and just value the whole property. And that's what bothers me, because this allows a second bite at the apple by the assessors, and the fact that they do a residual method is neither here nor there, because their valuation is their methodology may perhaps be faulty. Doesn't make sense to me why we wouldn't then look at components versus total. And I'm not sure this is the fix in deteriorating or eroding taxpayers' rights in the appeal process.
Further comments? We'll call for a roll vote.
Aye.
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 No.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Aye. The motion passes. It will go to the floor. Representative Barnhart, would you like to carry
sure.
this? I'm going to ask Representative Barnhart to carry. And with that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2572. And members, it appears that the fiscal that we are waiting for is not forthcoming. So in the immortal words of my co-chair, I believe we have exhausted our agenda. Oh, yeah, I'm going to carry over House Bill 2328 till Wednesday. The others will reappear magically at some point, so don't lose them.
Right.
Okay? And I believe that our Revenue Committee meeting is adjourned. Thank you. It is adjourned.